Good afternoon, everyone. So this is Ari, and we're at the with the lender legal update again for this month for May. I'm just going to give it a second before I get started because I know I'm actually logging in a minute or two early. So give everybody a minute, and we'll get started. Okay, so starting promptly, wanted to kind of go through today. Figured what a lot of people don't realize is actually the Financial Choice Act 2.0 was passed yesterday in terms of not passed the House and Senate, but it got through committee, and so it will now go on to be attempted to get approved essentially through the House and the Senate is kind of the next step for it. Why that's significant is. There are substantial revisions to the Dodd-Frank that affect mortgage banks and real lenders in general that if passed would change a lot of the ways that the CFPB works and affect kind of the way businesses get run from the lending perspective. The first thing to know is let's talk about what it would and wouldn't happen, and where – and the other thing I want you to take is, like, this is going to be something that's going to be part of a discussion. There are going to be lobbying interests impacting this, and there are significant things that as banks you really want to – especially for your community banks in particular, or what the CFPB refers to as non-banks, mortgage lenders that are not depositories, that could really affect you by these rules. So it's extremely important that you're aware of them, and to the extent you're willing to, and I suggest you should, really take a look at this, think about it, and potentially get involved in the discussion, because the outcome of this really could shape your business substantially in the years to come. So don't be in the scenario of excuse me for not sort of attacking anybody here, but you don't want to whine about it later, right? You want to deal with it now, because while there are some very good points to this that I think everyone will be happy about this, there are some kind of hidden risks, I think, especially for non-depositories, that they need to be looking at, because there could be a significant advantage in this law to depository institutions. So let me kind of go through specifically what those are. First of all, everyone's going to jump for joy. The CFPB would actually be gone. It would not exist anymore. Okay, there would be no CFPB. Now, here's sort of the downside. Instead, we're going to get the CLEA, which is the Consumer Law Enforcement Agency. So, kind of a joke there, right? I mean, no CFPB, but congratulations, now you have the CLEA. In many respects, they're the same thing. One of the big changes is that the CLEA would have a director that would be appointed at the will of the president. So, for example, if Trump didn't want to have Cordura anymore, that's a possibility, right? We all know what would happen. But he would be able to appoint someone of his choosing to run the agency. I will tell you that will certainly be an area of major fighting in terms of when the legislation goes to the full House and Senate. Now, one other thing, though, putting that aside, regardless of who runs the agency, the agency is going to have a lot less power and a lot more oversight. And I think that's something all banks are going to be pretty happy with. First, there's essentially going to be what's called an inspector general and a requirement of economic oversight. What that means is that there would be somebody really whose job is to oversee the agency. And in addition, anytime the agency, the CLEA, the Consumer Law Enforcement Agency, wanted to pass new legislation, it would have to be proposed to and evaluated by an Office of Economic Oversight that would essentially require there be a benefit-cost analysis to the economy relating to the benefits of the regulations and determine whether it made sense. So that would certainly limit the agency's autonomy. I will tell you, some of that really already is done by the CFPB. In other words, when you see new laws come out, they generally do some type of economic impact analysis and put it in the thousands of pages. It's buried in there, but it is there if you've decided to take the time to read them. Ultimately, what they always conclude is, but we decide it's worth it anyhow, right? So, you know, I don't know that whole economic oversight component is actually such a big deal at the end of the day, because if all the economic oversight says is, well, we think it's worth it, then who cares, right? The inspector general requirement, I think, would be beneficial because it would sort of give somebody literally overseeing the regulator. The other thing where I think it's really important, and this would be, you know, I'm hopeful that this change will ultimately find its way into legislation in particular, is that it would provide individuals subject to the CFPB some level of appeal rights. Here's what I mean by that. Let's say that you are subject to an enforcement action, and they're bringing an enforcement action against you on an administrative basis. The way it currently works now is that you have to go through this whole administrative process, spend all the time and money, and ultimately, as we saw in the PHH case, Richard Cordray gets to make the decision of what's going to happen to you, period, end of story. Judge, jury, executioner, right? Well, the way this would work now is, let's say you're in this process of administrative enforcement, and you decide, this is a joke, right? The ALJ isn't listening to me, and ultimately all I'm going to do is appeal to the director, and I'm going to get dinged there. You know, I really need, like, somebody outside this agency involved. Well, you would have the right to immediately petition for to go to court. So, in other words, just stop the administrative process. We want to go to court, and we want to fight in court. That will obviously save you a lot of money and a lot of time, and, you know, could be a benefit. The other thing that does is it certainly creates an oversight component, because if the administrative process is functioning in an arbitrary or unfair manner, everyone's just going to opt to go to court. So it sort of indirectly deters that sort of unfettered, what we feel like doing concept with respect to enforcement actions in the CFPB. The other thing that's really, I think, extremely important is that companies who are being examined would have the opportunity to essentially appeal that examination to what's probably going to be the inspector general type agency. So if you're in a scenario where you have an examiner coming in, and we've all seen this in the state court, you know, certainly in states, where, you know, the examiner spilled his cup of coffee or her cup of coffee on the way to your office, not in a really good mood, and just starts ripping you apart for every little thing they see, or you have somebody who truly doesn't understand things enough, and they create a lot of problems for you, and you have to go through this whole, you know, situation. Well, unlike the scenario now, where in many cases, especially with the CFPB, your only appeal is to the very agency that just audited you and told you have to do this, who examined you, you would have now the opportunity to actually go to a different agency and get almost like an appellate type review for an exam finding. Obviously, again, that would be very, very useful. So I think that would create a lot of consistency. And, you know, look, the bottom line is there has to be oversight to the regulator. And right now there isn't. I mean, I do think that's a problem. We all recognize this, that the CFPB does what it feels like in many respects. And it's been able to, and it was created with that type of power. But this would limit that. And so not only does that give you some rights if you're disadvantaged by a certain process, but I think for all companies it gives a greater degree of predictability and consistency, because if you have arbitrariness, in other words, if you have oversight, you're going to have less arbitrariness. And so the mere fact that it's there is going to, I think, limit the extent to which we sort of get some of these arbitrary and rash decisions that nobody understands, or really aggressive interpretations of laws that people don't agree with. So I simply think that oversight point would be highly important. And so far, I know I haven't gotten to sort of the dark lining of the silver cloud here, which we're going to talk about in a few minutes. I'll probably leave that for last because I think it involves the most discussion. The other thing is that they're going to require the CFPB to, or sorry, CLEA, to have a opinion, essentially implement an advisory opinion process. Now, the CFPB certainly has something today, which is essentially that if you have a new technology or product, they will evaluate it and tell you with great limitations whether, you know, it violates any specific law. Although this review that currently exists is extremely limited and only deals with certain aspects and doesn't pretend you know, any other agency or state from coming after you. So it's a pretty limited utility compared to what they're talking about. I mean, they're talking about a true advisory opinion where you'd be able to come in and say, hey, this is what we're doing or we want to do. Would it be okay? And with certain limitations, not that many, but some, you would actually be able to get an answer from an agency or from the agency, which I think obviously, again, I think it would be very helpful because one of the big areas we have is we still have these, you know, these pockets of gray all over the place where people really don't know the answers. And so you have people who are willing to take more risk doing one thing and other people who are not willing to take the risk doing another. And by being, quote unquote, more compliant, you have, you know, disadvantaged yourself from a competitive perspective. Yet at the same time, you don't want to be a risk taker. So I think this would lend a great degree of predictability because lenders would be able to, and obviously the agencies that that represent lenders or the cooperatives, coalitions, whatever you want to call them, would be able to go forth and ask these questions on behalf of members. And so I think that would be a huge benefit for banks. One of the areas that they're also talking about is amending the ability to repay laws. So, you know, the laws relating to QM and non-QM. So to provide the additional flexibility for products. Now, here's where it starts getting, you know, whether it's intended or not intended, let's talk about that. But here's where it starts getting, I think, very interesting for non-depository lenders. What they're talking about setting up is a structure where a depository institution, if it elected at the outset to, or not even at the outset, if it says that it intends to hold a loan for the life of that loan, then it can really do what it, like, basically, if it's going to do it, it treats that loan as a non-QM. As a QM, even if it's otherwise a non-QM. So, for instance, if you wanted to have, you know, some certain type of loan that, let's say, I mean, theoretically, stated income loan, okay? If it's at least the way it looks in the statute, if they want to have a stated income loan, a depository institution could do that, okay? Now, obviously, that's going to create a scenario, but they have to intend to hold it. So here's some of the problems. First of all, intend when. I mean, we already know how this works with respect to loans that are done, you know, for investment or not for investment properties, but essentially, you know, borrower occupancy fraud, right? And the problem in enforcing it is, what did you intend to do? Well, when I moved in for a month ago, I intended to live here, and I've changed my mind. I don't like the neighborhood, so I'm leaving, and now I'm renting it out, right? You know, it would be pretty tough to show what somebody intended at that moment. So it isn't clear how long do you hold it to show an intent to hold it exists. You could see where you could actually throw, you know, that could be a huge loophole, number one. And number two, you know, where that's really important is because if they're able to get things off their lines in some fairly short period of time, relatively speaking, there could be a whole array of diversification of products that only depository institutions could offer. So all of you, you know, that are on this call that are not depository could be significantly disadvantaged because you would be subject to all the non-QM rules, right, and the QM rules, ATR, whereas depositories could simply, by intending to hold the loan, putting that word intending in quotes, have really almost any, there's some small limitations, but have almost any products they wanted. So that would obviously be a big disadvantage for you. Now, obviously, if they interpret the word intend much more strictly and say you have to hold the loan for the life of the loan, that gets even more interesting because, again, small depositories who don't have the ability to flip those lines over, right? In other words, they can only hold in portfolio these loans for so long because they just have so much money, right? In other words, you're going to run out of space. So you could only do so many loans this way, and then you wouldn't be able to because you have to really hold them. Well, for larger depositories, it becomes then even a bigger advantage, right? The longer intend becomes defined. So that really only the biggest depositories would have the opportunity to have these diversified products. Again, if you have a very, very, very long time, you know, you have to hold it for at least 10 years, then maybe that's less so, because even large institutions, eventually kind of you can only have so much space held up on your portfolio, especially on riskier types of loans. But the overall idea here, which isn't necessarily bad, is that if you're going to hold the loan, and that's your intent to hold it for the life of the loan, then why are we worried about ATR? Because obviously you wouldn't hold a loan thinking you're going to hold it for the life if you thought it might go bad, right? I mean, it makes sense from that perspective, but you've really got to see about how this could affect the market and the potential advantages or disadvantages to smaller community banks or to non-banks or non-depositories. It could have a significant disadvantage. Now, if you look into this, one thing you will see is that originators would also, of these types of loans that are going to be held by the creditor, okay, for the life of the loan, would also, it's interesting, they would actually take away the rules pertaining to steering, right, that currently exists from, you know, out of or steering towards a non-QM loan, you can't steer. They would actually take that provision out of the rule. So essentially, that would be omitted, meaning that originator could steer a loan to a non-QM to a depository, and there would be no liability for that. That's actually what it says. Now, I think what they're getting at is just that if an originator originates a loan, I think that's what they're trying to do, for a depository that is a non-QM, there's going to be no liability to the originator or the creditor, as long as the creditor intends to hold the loan for the life of the loan. Either way, right, the reality is that it protects it. You could see this creating almost a TPO situation for depository institutions. And again, even further, the larger the institution and if the timing is right on how intend gets defined to hold a loan, really put the TPO channels back on and put the TPO channels back on for depositories who would be the ones who would really be able to benefit from this. So I will tell you that other people in the industry have noticed this, not just me, and are watching it carefully. If you are a non-depository or small community bank, you should really be looking at this, because this aspect of the law, I don't know if it was intended to do this, but it would certainly put you in a competitive disadvantage on lots. And, you know, you just wouldn't be able to offer the same thing depositories would, period, end of story. So, you know, in a market like this, where, again, the refi boom's a little bit down, you could see, you know, you could almost see another refi boom starting for other types of loans, but they would not be ones you could participate in. So I strongly encourage you to be watching this. It's something that you should be talking to your various political, you know, contacts and taking a look at this, because this could be a big, big deal for you guys. One thing you're going to be happy about is they do seem to be embracing the idea of transitional licensing, which will enable people to leave from depositories to go to smaller banks and non-depositories, non-federally insured institutions, without having to get new licenses. Now, you know, by the way, obviously, if point one happens, which is that depositories can offer a lot of products that non-depositories can't, then there's going to be a whole lot less of a need for transitional licensing, because fewer and fewer people are going to leave depositories because of that, the array of products they'll be able to offer. So those are some of the things that I think are high points. Another thing to realize is that they also are carving out of the agency, of the CLEA, the ability to impose enforcement actions on essentially UDAP, unfair deceptive acts or practices. That would be limited to other financial regulators, such as the FDIC, OTS, okay? But the CFPB, or what would be now called the CLEA, would not have the ability to impose fines for violations of unfair deceptive acts or practices. So that would be another area where they really have cut down the authority of the agency. So I do think there's some very good things about this law in terms of, you know, getting rid of some of that unpredictability and eliminating some of that uncertainty that has been plaguing the industry over the last several years. But understand there's a cloud to this silver lining, which is the way it's set up, especially for small-owned community banks, could create a lot of harm. Now, in terms of, you know, day-to-day regulations, things like LO Comp and TRID and everything else, the Financial Choice Act 2.0 really doesn't get into that. There's no provision that says these regulations are eliminated for, you know, small community banks, you know, nothing like that. I will tell you there's a provision that says small community banks won't be supervised, quote unquote, anymore by the CLEA. That doesn't mean a whole lot, just so I understand it, because the CFPB did less than 2% of examinations of all non-banks last year, less than 2%. So 98% of the audits and examinations that institutions that are non-depositories got last year came from entities other than the CFPB. So the fact that you're, quote, not going to be supervised by them anymore, the CLAEA now really isn't going to change. It's not going to affect things for 98% of you. It's not going to have any impact. The CLAEA could still pass regulations that would affect you. The CLA could still bring enforcement actions against you if it wanted to. So, again, I don't know this whole lack of supervision. I think that's more political, sort of like saying we're getting rid of the CFPB. Not really. The CLAEA is going to be there. One thing that also does seem to indicate is that it's going to get rid of some of these public complaint channels, get rid of some of the reporting and talked about, like the reporting they were talking about doing with some of the HMDA data where it could be publicly disseminated. So it seems that they're going to cut back at that greatly, basically increasing the privacy to individuals, and that's the tack they're taking on this. So I think that one probably has a lot of meat that it could rely upon, because there were a lot of political groups that were uncomfortable with what the CFPB was proposing in terms of sharing information. So I think that's an area that will probably have some rights to passage. The other area where they're talking about is also changing the way the agency is funded. Right now, as you know, the appropriations process is such that Congress has very little oversight. They would be sort of ripping that down and providing Congress with a great level of oversight in terms of CLEA appropriations. Another area where I think that would be beneficial for banks, because again, we have some control points. So, I mean, if you're really examining the Financial Choice Act 2.0 or interested in what's happening, and again, given what we've talked about today, I truly hope you are, because it could affect your business significantly. I think there's some good points, right? There's going to be more oversight, less autonomy for the CLEA, less arbitrariness, higher level of consistency and continuity, and predictability to enforcement and examination. I do think, however, that some of the stuff with the depositories being able to have certain products effectively that you as non-depositories can have, especially as they're larger and larger depositories, could be, game-changing. And so I think everybody needs to understand that. And again, sometimes you don't even know if the politicians, who are voting on this understand those impacts. And I think it's important that they do, because whatever side of the political spectrum you're on, if you're a non-depository or a small community bank, this thing could have a really big impact on you, and the benefit that you get from this predictability and, less of the judge, jury, execution, I'm the CFPB, the more that goes away if it's replaced with something that has a huge opportunity for depositories to expand their business at your expense. Obviously, you've got a way where you want to come down on that. That's your choice. So that's essentially what I wanted to bring up today. I know we'll be finishing a little bit early, but I thought this was nonetheless something incredibly important, because, again, this just got passed committee, okay? So it is on the way to becoming legislation and becoming law. I'm not saying it's going to become law, because it has not been passed by the House. It has not been passed by the Senate. It hasn't even been argued yet, and I promise you when that happens, it will change, right? But that is the time where you want to have your voice heard, is during that conversation. Because after it could pass the House and Senate is not the time to be talking about it or worrying about it. That's the time where you better start dealing with it, because it's going to happen. So there, again, I'm not saying these things are law. I'm saying though they are on their way, and there's certainly a lot of things to stop them. And if you are not happy about it, then you should have your voice heard. Maybe certain parts can be kept, certain parts should be changed. All types of things could happen here, right? But you could certainly see both the silver lining and the cloud here, I think. So hopefully this helps you and gives you some information that you can use to protect your business both that today and moving forward. And I really appreciate the time you've taken to listen to me today, and I hope you found it helpful. So everybody have a great weekend. Have a great May, and I will see you, or talk to you, I guess, in next month, in June. Thanks a lot, everybody. Bye.